Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oprah and Rush Limbaugh look pretty big these days with their audiences of maybe 20 million. Will Rogers reached 60 million when America's population was not half what it is now. In the 1920s and 30s, Will Rogers was huge. No one today can compare. A genial cowboy comedian who, says my guest today, moved the nation, set the stage for the political humor of Jon Stewart and much more. This hour On Point, Will Rogers and American political humor. You can join the conversation. Who's more influential today? Pundits, politicians, comedians? Do you have a cultural memory of Will Rogers, his clout? Is there anyone today who speaks to Americans, all Americans, the way Will Rogers did? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is Richard D. White, professor of public administration and associate dean at Louisiana State University, biographer of President Theodore Roosevelt and Louisiana Senator Huey Long in his book Kingfish. His new biography is Will Rogers, A Political Life. Richard White, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
It's good to be back, Tom.
Will you just listen with us for a minute here? We're going to talk to a little bit of Will Rogers. I mean, it's interesting. You'd have to be, I don't know, maybe 100 or something now to really remember anything of Will Rogers in his heyday. Yet the sound of his voice, his attitude that has somehow lingered in our cultural memory. On the other hand, as you may well know, Richard, there's a lot of young people today who may never have caught even a whiff of Will Rogers. I got a little archival tape here. We'll start with Will Rogers delivering his iconic opening line about, you know, everything he learned. Well, here's where he learned it.
Now, folks, all I know is what I read in the papers.
Just a simple fella. All he knows is what he reads in the newspapers. Over 60 million Americans listen to Will Rogers' weekly radio broadcast. It ran Sunday evenings from 1930 to 35. It was called Will Rogers and His Famous Alarm Clock, in reference to the wind-up, old-timey alarm clock that he told him when time was up on the hour. Here he is joking about spending, even then, spending, and daylight savings.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, Will Rogers and his famous alarm clock, broadcasting from Los Angeles, California.
Thank you very much. We're here an hour earlier today. It seems kind of funny to be, was everybody advised to spend and the government spending everything, and then it seems sort of funny for somebody to save a little daylight nowadays.
Spending, the issue then and now, and daylight savings, the only one maybe he could find to point at. Richard White, it is interesting, and you write about this, how over the decades, Will Rogers has kind of been flattened to this, you know, a little bit corn-pone, homespun comedian, the guy who did rope tricks and, you know, all he knew was what he read in the newspapers. But you write that his influence is really hard for us to imagine today, the dimensions of it, the scale of it in his time.
Absolutely. From just before World War I, through the Jazz Age, all through Prohibition, the Great Depression, and up until Rogers' tragic death in a plane crash in 1935, he captivated the nation and the world with not only his humor, but his political commentary. During the last 2 years of his life, he was the top male box office attraction at the movies. The only person who topped him was Shirley Temple. As you said, he was one of the most widely read newspaper columnists. He put out over 600 weekly newspaper columns, over 2,800 daily newspaper columns. He was in 71 movies and wrote 6 books. All of this outpouring of media, of words, propelled him to a level of influence unequaled in American history.
You talk about king of all media. I mean, he is 60 million in a radio audience today. Rush Limbaugh, he's got, I don't know what it is now, 20 million, maybe more, and that's considered absolutely vast. The United States in 1930, I think there were only 120 million Americans, and Will Rogers had 60 million of them listening to him on the radio. You write that politicians knew very well what the influence of this man was. Their doors were open to him.
Absolutely. He... I think the bottom line is trust. Will was absolutely trusted by the American people. He told it like he saw it. His insights, if you look at them, they're as pertinent today as when he made them. He criticized political corruption, crime, international disputes, economic hardship. His reporting seems clear, more direct, more nonpartisan, and closer to the truth when compared to today's news coverage. He didn't have an axe to grind. He did not worry about being politically correct. He did not attempt to give his audience a, quote, fair and balanced analysis. In one of his first newspapers, he promised his readers only the truth, pledging to, quote, lay my chips a little different. I'm going to take it a shot at the whole works myself, and I want it to go as she lays.
He took a shot at a lot. I'm just looking down here. I mean, just quip after quip, quote after quote from Will Rogers. You get a sense of how he went after a politics and politicians. Will Rogers says, ancient Rome declined because it had a Senate. Now what's going to happen to us with both a Senate and a House? It says, diplomacy is the art of saying nice doggy until you can find a rock.
Yeah,
we understand that in these days with warplanes all over. Famously, he said, I belong to no organized party. I am a Democrat. And then this one, 10 men in the country could buy the world, and 10 million can't buy enough to eat. He wasn't a politician, but you make the case he was deeply in politics. So what were his politics, Richard White?
Well, as he said, he wasn't a member of any organized party. He was a Democrat.
More a jibe at the Democratic Party than a statement
exactly.
on where he stood.
Right. He was relatively nonpartisan, but that doesn't mean he didn't have strong feelings about issues. He was conservative on financial issues, but I think he was pretty liberal on human values. The other quote, I never met a man I didn't like, mm-hmm. and he meant it.
But he used that even when he sat down with Benito Mussolini, which got a lot of flack for.
Well, Rogers loved his fellow man. When he said he never met a man he didn't like, he meant it. But he also mistrusted mankind and the modern huge monoliths of government, bureaucracy, and large corporations. He defended democracy, but he had little faith in the political or economic systems of his day to actually improve common man's lot. He thought politics was the lowest of life forms, yet he befriended every politician he met. He decried corruption, yet expressed sympathy for individuals found guilty of it, like those in Teapot Dome or the Black Sox scandal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He feared extremist organizations from the Ku Klux Klan to the Communist Party, yet he could share a friendly cup of coffee with their members, including a dictator from Italy.
What was up with that? Didn't he know what Mussolini was up to? He was certainly very concerned about the Japanese with their invasion of China, Manchuria, and the Far East. Could he not see where Europe was heading?
I think if Will had a fault, he was a little naive with human nature. He trusted people too much. At the time and throughout his life, Will was fearful of chaos. He feared any sort of internal unrest or rebellion. And he liked what he saw with Mussolini cleaning up Italian society. You know, he had the trains running on time. And until Mussolini invaded Ethiopia right before Will died, Will was a champion of Mussolini. But once he invaded Ethiopia, like Hitler's saber rattling, Will backed away from both of those dictators.
You make the case that Will Rogers, in some ways single-handedly, opened up American politics for the kind of humor and comedy and very freighted comedy that we're so familiar with today, that he was one of the first to, right in the face of a president, make jokes about that president.
Yeah, absolutely. Early in his stage career, and just before America entered World War I, Rogers stood in front of Woodrow Wilson on a Baltimore stage, and he jokingly criticized the president for his naive pacifism and Wilson's reluctance to arm the nation. Before Rogers went on the stage, he was very nervous. No one had ever criticized the president. At the time, it was unheard of. Indeed, it was unpatriotic for an entertainer to make fun of a president, to question an official policy, broach touchy political subjects. But as Rogers was talking, as he was criticizing the president, he looked out at the audience, and to his relief, Wilson was laughing more heartily than anybody else. So by successfully criticizing a president face-to-face, Rogers paved the way not only for his own brand of political humor, but also for dozens of political satirists who continue to follow in his footsteps.
And today we've got Jon Stewart and Louis Black and Stephen Colbert and all the rest. Here's a little bit of Will Rogers. This is archival tape again, riffing on Americans and our attitude toward our leaders.
We're wonderful with our president. When the sun is shining, we cheer them. And let it start raining, and if they don't furnish us, some umbrella and some goulashes that's furnished by the government, well, boy, we give them the boot right then.
We're good when it's fair weather, and when the clouds come, we'll give them the boot right then, said Will Rogers, way back in the day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cowboy comedian Will Rogers and his political footprint, the rustic past master who cleared the way for Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and a whole lot more. Richard D. White joins us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's author of the new biography, Will Rogers, A Political Life. He looks at the humor, yes, and the life of the great king of all media of that time, but also at his very real influence on the American politics of that day with an enormous public following and with presidents and politicians of all stripes. Let's hear a little more of Will Rogers. This is from what's been described as his first political speech. It's at a town hall meeting in Ogden Mills supporting Ogden Mills for Congress at the invitation of Theodore Roosevelt's son, Kermit. The New York Times reported that his comedic talk there was, quote, something new for a political meeting and won a large number of laughs.
This is my first crack at a political speech, and I hope it flops. I don't want it to get over. If it did, it might lead me in politics. And up to now, I have tried to live honest. Now, a great many think I was sent here to speak by my candidate's opponent, but that is not the case. I don't know him, but he must be a scoundrel, because from what I have read of politics, every opponent is a scoundrel and a tool of the interest.
From what I have read of politics, he says there, every opponent is a scoundrel and a tool of the interests. Richard White, when did he begin to slide from, I mean, here he was in the Ziegfeld Follies doing lariat tricks, rope tricks, and pretty soon he's right in the middle of the country's politics, writing thousands of newspaper columns, even campaigning in this instance. Was it a definitive moment when he went that way, or did it just grow gradually?
Well, Rogers was a very nervous entertainer, and he made his career early as a rope twirler, and he would miss some tricks, and every now and then when he'd miss a trick, he'd make a joke to try to break the ice, mm-hmm. And over time he kept adding more and more jokes to the rope tricks, and one morning at breakfast, his wife suggested that he start talking about politics. And eventually he started talking more and more, became more and more comfortable with talking about the front page every morning, and eventually discarded the rope.
The rope went away, politics all over it, and not just politics. He said, there's no trick to being a humorist when you have the whole government working for you, I guess giving you material. That's something Jon Stewart et al. Would relate to today. Will Rogers said, the country has come to feel the same when Congress is in session as when the baby gets hold of a hammer. And on human nature, we don't know what we want, but we're ready to bite somebody to get it. Tell us about his background. He wasn't doing rope tricks by accident, Richard White. He really did grow up in cowboy country with a lot of Cherokee background.
Yes, he was a part Indian. Both his mother and father were part Indians. He grew up in the Indian Territory, which is now part of Oklahoma. His father was a politician helped to bring Oklahoma into the Union. His mother was a bright, humorous lady where he got a lot of his talent from. They were middle class. His father was a successful rancher, banker, politician, who had served as a cavalry officer in the Confederate Army in the Civil War. So they had the money to send Will off to private school, but private school did not match with Will Rogers. He wanted to be outside, and after 8 years of eighth grade education, he left, and he took off, and on his own, he took his first trip around the world as a ranch hand.
Went to Argentina to try and set up his own ranching operation there. I guess that failed. Ended up on a ranch in South Africa, of all things. I mean, this was a very worldly man. He really did travel the globe.
He really did. He went around the world four times. He was on another trip around the world when he died in Alaska with Wiley Post. That was a huge education to him. He knew people around the world. He was fascinated with their culture. He would stop and talk with people on the streets. He was as comfortable with a person in a flea bag restaurant as he was with the King of England.
We've got a lot of listeners calling in on the Will Rogers front. His humor, his political impact. We're with Richard White. His new book is Will Rogers, A Political Life. 800-423-8255. Let's get a call from New York, West Hampton, New York. And Jack, hi, Jack. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I remember when I was a small boy hearing about Mr. Rogers, Will Rogers. And I remember that he was always misunderstood from his famous quote, "I never met a man I didn't like." He explained that in one interview where he said, "I once met Adolf Hitler. I thought he was a very amiable, very personable guy. He's also mad as a March hare." what he intended by the statement was that he didn't prejudge people before he actually met them himself. He gave them a chance to impress or disappoint him in person instead of making up his mind just based on hearsay.
Jack, that's very interesting. Let me pick it up with Richard White. I mean, both the origins of that phrase, never met a man I didn't like. I'd love to hear you on that, Richard White. But also, there is a philosophy at work in it, a philosophy that maybe not so evident today that, okay, let's start with an open mind.
Absolutely. Jack is on point. The only person I can find that that would fit that phrase, I never met a didn't like, and refute it, was Al Capone. Several journalists had interviews with Al Capone in the 30s, and Will was given an open venue with Al, who was in jail at the time. He refused to interview him. He says, I'm not going to make this man any more famous than he is. And he took a hard stand on that. So that was one of the only examples of someone he hadn't met before that he didn't like before he even met him.
Al Capone was the limit on that open-mindedness, I guess. Laura in Concord, Massachusetts. Laura, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My dad, Seth Bilzerian, a lineman, 82 years old now, really reminds me of Will Rogers. His book was on our mantle next to Abe Lincoln, and he always said, "I never met a man I didn't like." Outdoors, always interested in politics, and liked to drop a very pithy point with humor. A lot like Will Rogers, really. And also, I have a question about my dad was a son of Armenian immigrants.
Uh-huh.
How did Will Rogers impact immigrants in those days? And were they among his fans?
That's a great question, Laura. I appreciate your calling in with it. He was so much about the kind of homespun Americana sound, Richard White. Where was he on the immigrant front? We had a lot of immigrants in those years.
Well, on an individual basis, Will treated every person the same. But he still had the biases of the time. His phraseology, for example, he talked about Mussolini, and he said, "He's one wise wop." Will occasionally used the N-word for African Americans, to
his
regret.
And got in trouble for it even way back then.
Right, and I think he was very hurt by his fault there. One of his quotes, for example, is, "Our Constitution protects aliens, drunks, and U.S. senators." So you know, he was a little critical of wide immigration policies. He feared chaos. Anarchy movement was strong during the time, the communist movement. So I think that political fear spilled over a little bit toward his opinions of immigration.
He was definitely isolationist when it came to thinking about war.
Well, he was an isolationist, but he was not a pacifist. He felt the nation should be well-armed. He criticized all of the presidents for not building up the Army and the Navy, especially the Army Air Corps. He was a real fan of aviation, and probably more than anyone else except Charles Lindbergh convinced the American people of the safety of aviation and the need for strong military aviation.
And then, ironically, of course, died in an airplane crash in near Barrow, Alaska in 1935. He was 55 years old then. Talk to us about his politics as the country moved into the Depression. He had a relationship with both Hoover and FDR, but ultimately much more associated, I guess, with Roosevelt.
Yes, and Will was pretty supportive of Hoover. He felt Hoover was at the wrong place at the wrong time. He criticized him for not acting more decisively when the Depression fell. But a good example of Will's power even then during Hoover was Hoover went on national radio to convince the American public to take some action against the early days of the Depression. Hoover asked only one person to be on the air with him. That was Will Rogers. And Will, while he was on the air, actually criticized the president, and Hoover went along with it. But it was not until FDR came in that you really see Rogers' power coming to the front.
I've got a little tape here of Will Rogers first talking about Democrats and Republicans. Republicans, I guess. This is a 1935 interview on the Man of the Year television program, no less. And he's talking here about what his life might have been had he not joined the entertainment industry.
Had there been no Ziegfeld and no Follies, I would today have been 12 miles north of Clam, Oklahoma, plowing for corn, slopping the hogs, running my own still, and knocking the Republican Party. Because that is considered one of the chores in my country.
Knocking the Republican Party, one of the chores of his country. Of course, he had plenty of tart phrases for Democrats as well. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to say that today Will Rogers wouldn't be allowed to speak.
Why not?
I'm from Claremo, around Claremo, Oklahoma, where Will was born and raised, and I'm 76 years old. And today he's my hero, and I try to be a comedian here in Nashville and do the same thing on talk radio and stuff, and they'll cut me off. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but what kind of thing would Will Rogers say that you couldn't say today?
What I'm saying is Will wouldn't be allowed to speak today. You know what I'm saying? If he was alive.
Because he,
I mean. And thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, Jim. I appreciate your call very much. How about it, Richard? Will says what? He'd be too controversial to be on the air, and yet he seemed to try and wrap everything in an awfully familiar wrapper. What do you say, Richard?
Well, I think it would be just the opposite. I think Will would have trouble with acceptance because he's not extreme enough. To make it in today's media, you have to be pretty polarized, and I think he would be very critical of the media now that it's either hard left or hard right. And there's not a lot of options for middle-of-the-road commentators, especially on the networks. And that's why, in many ways, the political humorists are successful, because they are some of the few pundits who are actually in the middle.
Of course, when he said, and I don't have the quote in front of me now, but, you know, 10 men could buy the world and 10 million can't afford to eat, that's got a lot of bite to it, even now.
It does. It was the same message that Huey Long was spouting, the chicken in every pot. But Will was not a socialist. He did not believe in welfare. One of my favorite quotes, he says, "What the country needs is dirtier fingernails and cleaner minds."
Dirtier fingernails and cleaner minds. Here's Will Rogers introducing Franklin Delano Roosevelt at a campaign rally in 1932. He refers to Al Smith, former governor of New York, who was twice nominated by FDR to be the Democratic nominee for president before being defeated by FDR in 32. By 32, Will Rogers had been an active political campaigner for a decade.
I knew this gentleman. That's why I can be rather familiar with him. I knew him almost in childhood. I knew him when he first started in nominating Al Smith for things. We must have some 80 or 90,000 people here tonight. That's the most people that ever paid to see a politician.
Will Rogers introducing FDR in 1932. What about the relationship between these two men, Richard White? Will Rogers, FDR.
It was very close. Even before Roosevelt was elected, he sent some private correspondence to Will, kind of warning Will to stay out of the political arena. I mean, Roosevelt was such a shrewd tactician, he feared even a Will Rogers going to the convention and being nominated and sapping away a few votes. But they were very close. Will sent Roosevelt several private telegrams giving him advice soon after he was elected. But after Roosevelt was elected, as I said before, that's when you really see Will Rogers' influence coming to pass. He endorsed Roosevelt's monetary policies, his relief programs, regulation of big business, high income taxes on the rich, even large scale deficit spending, and increasing jobs through public works. He was so influential that some Republican congressmen complained that he was influencing lawmaking, and a false rumor spread that Will Rogers was writing some of Roosevelt's speeches.
Was he ostracized by Republicans at that point, or was he so big they couldn't ostracize him?
No, he was friendly with all of them. When he walked into the Senate, he was the only outsider allowed into the Senate cloakroom. Everyone loved him, even the Republicans. Again, I think it was a matter of trust. When he hit them, he didn't hit them personally. He criticized based on issues, and they loved it.
They loved it, and yet he had that big public sway behind him. What was the heart of that public buy-in to the Will Rogers persona, do you conclude, Richard White?
Well, again, it's trust, but he spoke to the people. He had an eighth-grade education, and that was about the average education of the American public. Now, Will was not popular with intelligentsia. James Thurber disliked Will. The New York Times editors for years probably wanted to get rid of him, but he was just too popular for them to stop publishing him. But if you look around, if you get into the research, you'll find that there's some really brilliant men who thought the world of Will and thought that Will was also brilliant. You look at people like philosopher Will Durant, the playwright George Bernard Shaw, Bernard Baruch, Carl Sandburg, Henry Ford, even H.L. Mencken, who hated everybody. They loved Will Rogers. They thought he was brilliant, that he influenced public opinion, that he was well-read, that he had a keen knowledge of human nature. They all saw in Will Rogers a streak of genius.
Richard White, please stand by. In Baton Rouge, the new book is Will Rogers, A Political Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We went out of the last section with soundtrack from The Headless Horseman, 1922 silent film where Will Rogers played Ichabod Crane. This is from the Will Rogers Follies behind us right now, a musical on the life and career of Will Rogers, premiered on Broadway in 1991. Never met a man I didn't like. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Never met a man I didn't like. Highfalutin gent or Bowery bum. Yes, I've come a long way down the pike. Never met a man I
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cowboy comedian Will Rogers and his political footprint, a very big one, says my guest today, Richard White. He's written biographies of Theodore Roosevelt and Huey P. Long. His latest is Will Rogers, A Political Life. You can read an excerpt at our website. It really goes at the humor and this man's impact on American politics and culture. Richard White joins us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Here's a little bit more tape. This is from October 1931. In the midst of the Great Depression, Will Rogers and President Herbert Hoover, who he made appearances with before he became so close to FDR, addressed the nation together in a radio broadcast. Will's comments, titled Bacon, Beans, and Limousines, focused on the problem of unemployment.
There's not really but one problem before the whole country at this time. It's not the balancing of Mr. Mellon's budget. That's his worry. That ain't ours. And it's not the League of Nations that we read so much about. Or it's not the silver question. The only problem that confronts this country today is that at least 7 million people are out of work. That's our only problem.
Out of work, and that's our only problem. Richard White, stand by in Baton Rouge. Let's get a caller from Stanton, Virginia. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Just 2 points. I'm 63 years old. I was raised by an uncle who was born in 1904. He only had a fourth grade education, but two people he absolutely worshipped practically were Franklin Roosevelt and Will Rogers. And I heard a lot about Will Rogers in my growing up years, and I don't think we can imagine today how big a personality Will Rogers was in that day and time. Only one close might be Babe Ruth. The other point I have is a favorite quote that I attribute to Will Rogers, and that is, and it affects today when we are so inclined to only listen to our own points of view as far as politics. And I attribute this quote to Will Rogers when he said, "I'm not so concerned about what I don't know as I am about what I know that ain't so." And that's my only comment. Thank you.
David, I appreciate your call. What people know and don't know, ignorance and how we judge ignorance in others were big themes of Will Rogers, Richard White.
Absolutely. Will was a homespun Socrates. You know, he questioned the truth. He questioned everything he said, and he didn't take everything for granted. He was also always looking to improve himself. Everywhere he went, he had a newspaper under his arm. When he was traveling, he would have every newspaper from the region delivered to him. He was a sponge of information, and he was a very Socratic person. He was also, always looking for the truth and more knowledge.
Had fun with American character, the way the sky's always falling, things are always going to hell in a handbasket. Here he is in 1935, talking about how Americans are always wondering what the country is coming to.
I bet you when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock and they had the whole of the American continent, and all they had to do to get an extra 160 acres was shoot another Indian, you know? Well, I bet you anything, they kicked on the price of ammunition, you know? I bet they said, "What's this country coming to?" You know what I mean? Right, like we're doing now. You know, "What's this country coming to?"
Boy, you can hear the humor, and at the same time, this is a different time. All they have to do to get another 160 acres was shoot another Indian, and it's ho, ho, ho in that audience. He's a big part Cherokee himself, Richard White.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about Will making a trip to Asheville, North Carolina in March 1928. And while he was there, he went out to the Cherokee Reservation, which were his ancestors, and he entertained them. He tried to tell jokes and spin the rope for them, but the Cherokees did not crack a smile. They just stood there stoically in front of him. He told a few more stories, and they just stood there, and finally, Will lost his temper, and he started railing at Andrew Jackson, who forced the Indians to move to the Midwest in the 1830s. And he said, "I got no use for Jackson or any of his methods, for all he ever did was pounce on Indians. And there was a newspaper writer in the crowd, and he watched as Rogers faced Redden with anger. Then suddenly, Will became furious. His transformation was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And for 3 minutes, his astonished audience was treated to a demonstration of what primitive, instinctive hatred could be. Some long-forgotten, inbred memory welled up in Will Rogers' heart. The Cherokees still listened silently, and then, all of a sudden, the quiet was shattered by the screaming, blood-curdling war cry of the entire tribe, while Will Rogers stood white, trembling, and actually aghast at himself.
Wow. That is a moment.
Yeah.
And he wasn't just slightly Cherokee. It was big in his family.
And this wasn't humorous.
What do you make of that? Because, I mean, was the transformation into the man that every American liked? Was that the price he paid for that political access? Was he, sounds right there, like he was burying a lot of very hard historical understanding?
Absolutely. There's a lot of baggage we all carry. And, being a Native American, like any minority, I would imagine, that's never going to leave you. It's going to always be back there. And I think he felt he had to try harder from his early days because he was a part Native American.
We've got a comment, but he certainly wrapped himself in a kind of Americana that is a big part of what made him popular. And I've got, you were talking about those who were drawn to Will Rogers in the kind of intelligentsia and those who were not. A listener online, Anne, writes, "I can't hear the name Will Rogers without thinking of Sinclair Lewis's quote, which worked out to, I guess she means this is maybe a rough version of it, but when, Anne's quoting Sinclair Lewis here, broadly, I guess, when fascism comes to America, it will not come in jackboots, but wearing the homey face of Will Rogers, wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross." Do you know that quote from Sinclair Lewis, Richard White? What do you make of that?
I don't know. I know Sinclair Lewis, and I certainly know where he's coming from, I think the quote probably would be aimed more at a Huey Long and a populist. I believe in that quote. I think there's a lot. There was. I don't think it's as much now, but there was a great danger of rampant populism taking over and leading to demagogues like a Huey Long or a Father Coughlin during the 30s. We had a lot of very reactionary people around the country. We wanted answers to the Depression. Huey was giving some answers, as unrealistic as they were, mm-hmm. and Will disagreed with those. He thought Huey was a crackpot.
And Coughlin, what was his view there?
Same here. He distrusted extremes. In fact, Upton Sinclair probably would have won the governorship of California if Will had not refused to endorse him. And Upton Sinclair was a socialist and a famous writer who was very popular in California. So even the populist mood was strong out there.
I wonder if it's possible Anne's quoting Upton Sinclair there. I'm just not sure, but I appreciate your comment there, Anne. Bill in Somerset, Kentucky, you're on the air with Richard White.
Thank you. I'm doing research on Irvin S. Cobb. And Cobb and Will Rogers were great friends for a long time and were in the movies together. And Cobb turns toward the right in the 1930s, and Will Rogers stays kind of in the middle. Can you explain their relationship a little bit more to me?
Well, they were very close. Cobb was a screenwriter and an actor and very popular. And he was a very earthy guy. And that appealed to Will. Irving would drop by the ranch, and they'd sit around and tell stories. But no, I don't see any animosity between the two in any of the literature and any of the letters back and forth. I think they continued to think very highly of each other, even though there may have been some political differences. Will had political differences with everybody, but it never overcame his friendships.
He did have some of his own political involvement. Speaking of those movie years, made so many movies, he was mayor of Beverly Hills.
That's correct. Douglas Fairbanks' was behind the move. It was an unofficial mayorship. In fact, it created a little bit of controversy in Beverly Hills. And after that, after Will was the unofficial mayor, the very next year, they created a formal mayorship. But if you go to Beverly Hills and look at the plaque of mayors, you will see the number one mayor is indeed Will Rogers.
Let's go to Brad in Cooksville, Tennessee. Brad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a great subject. I just always think about a story my grandfather used to tell me. He was a big Will Rogers fan. And he was talking about when he met President Calvin Coolidge, who was known for being so straight-faced and never reacting to too much, that when Will Rogers went to meet him, his buddy Wiley Post bet him that he couldn't make Calvin Coolidge laugh.
Mm.
And they said when he was introduced, they said, you know, Mr. President, this is Will Rogers, this is President. And they said, Will smiled and stuck his hand out and said, pardon me, I didn't catch your name.
And Coolidge,
true story.
And Coolidge, what happened there, Brad, in your telly?
He busted out.
Cracked up. Pardon me, I didn't catch your name, Mr. President. And you say true, Richard White.
Absolutely.
That's the way to get maybe through to the very straightest guy. I want to ask you about the sort of line of descent of Will Rogers' comedy and where you might see it or not see it at work in our political culture today. A lot of people working in those fields now, he may have broken it open. Here's just a little bit of Jon Stewart on Comedy Central's The Daily Show this week. Here he is critiquing President Obama's communication on his decision to engage in military action against Libya.
10 days after we started bombing Libya, President Obama took to the podium to convince Americans that we should bomb Libya, starting 10 days ago.
Okay, Richard White, talk to us about Will Rogers' kind of comedic impulse and politics and how you see or don't see that at work in the many who are working that field today.
Yeah, Tom, I've spent a lot of time listening to current comics and comparing them to Will. I think there's a difference there with the way Jon Stewart approached that routine. Will would not have been as personal. He would not have gone right at the personal at the president directly. He would have been more obtuse. I think he would have been more issue directed. I think the person who speaks more like Will Rogers, and you may disagree, is Lewis Black. If you take away Lewis's F words, you'll see that he's pretty balanced, and he's more complaining about the system rather than the individual people, and he's more issue-based.
You may be right. Here's Lewis Black on The System. This is Black on Broadway, 2004, in the midst of the George W. Bush years.
We have a two-party system. The Democratic Party, which is a party of no ideas, and the Republican Party, which is a party of bad ideas. And the way it works is the Republican stands up in Congress and goes, I got a really bad idea. And the Democrat says, and I can make it.
Beep, as in I can make it worse. Lewis Black may be heir to the legacy of Will Rogers. You're certainly right, Richard White. He's talking system there. System.
I think you're, again, you're on point. I was looking at a couple of quotes that Lewis could use. Will Rogers said, quote, Democrats never agree on anything. That's why they're Democrats. If they agree with each other, they would be Republicans.
Janice in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, if I could get Janice in here. Richard, yeah. You're on the air, Janice.
Hi, Tom. Both of my parents grew up in Oklahoma. My mom was 8 when Will Rogers died, but she remembered clearly when the news came of his death, where she was, what she was doing. And in her memory, only Pearl Harbor outranked that. He wasn't just a big star to her. He was someone that she loved. And she passed that love on to all of her children. And I'm 61, but I grew up knowing and loving Will Rogers. And I would recommend that anyone who wants to know him better to go to the Will Rogers Memorial
Absolutely.
Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma. It is still just wonderfully effective, and you'll come away knowing that you, feeling that you know him.
Janice, it's good advice and good testimony
Absolutely.
Right there. That's just great. I want to get just a little more tape. This is from the sad end of Will Rogers in 1935. Of course, as Richard White says he was a big proponent of air travel and aviation, then went down in an air crash. Here's a newsreel about his death, 1935.
The most shocking tragedy of the year, the deaths of Will Rogers and Wiley Post that stunned the world. Off from Seattle went the smiling cowboy humorist. His last goodbye. Like a pair of schoolboys, the two adventurers headed for the north on a holiday trip. And then suddenly, journey's end.
Suddenly, journey's end, and Will Rogers dead at 55. All these years later, if we can, Richard White, what's the most important thing to your mind after the work you've done here that we as a nation might, the most positive thing we might hold on to from Will Rogers' view of the world?
Well, an openness and a trust for dissenting opinion. I think Will would be very upset with the polarization that's in politics and in the media and in many ways in society today. I think we need a lot more human dignity in how we treat each other. Like I said, Will treated every man like he was his brother. And I think he would be very... very caustic about society today.
Well, he might have. It's not as though he didn't have a little bit of an edge to him. Even then, Will Rogers said, remember, write to your congressman. Even if he can't read, write to him. Richard White, this has been wonderful. I'm so grateful to you for your time, for your work on this new biography, Will Rogers, A Political Life. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You'll get a pretty good feel for it right there. Come back to us next time with your next book, Richard. We like the way you're pounding them out here. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Tom. I really enjoyed it.
Richard White, joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll go out with a little bit of Will Rogers. Here he is himself skewering Bing Crosby and Crosby's crooning style in song. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Are you listening?